Hello and welcome to Ad Hoc History.
It's not the history podcast you wanted. It's the history podcast you deserve. Hello.
That's right. Hello. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. We have a very special guest back on the show. We have Derek Hunter, our resident Shakespeare expert and author, back to share some new a new book you're working on. Yeah,
Hello,
welcome,
yes.
Derek.
It's great to be on here again with you guys. The first time was fantastic, and I'm excited about this time too. And sir, absolutely, a man obsessed with Shakespeare, I think, is probably the appropriate way to describe me. So yeah, definitely, I ever since my teens have been obsessed with Shakespeare. So it's great to anytime I get an opportunity to talk about it is a great time for me, and especially with you both. Just anyone who's got an interesting mind, a stimulating mind, as you both do, it is exciting for me to talk about this.
Yeah, right on. Well, I definitely admire a healthy obsession myself and kind of being a fly on the wall watching you kind of go through these different lines of reasoning and different, lines of investigation with this work has been really interesting. So I'm so excited to hear about anonymous agnostic Antichrist and the new work that you're working on, kind of continuing this alternative Shakespeare investigation. So I'm curious, before we get into this, how controversial is this? Are you getting like death threats from Shakespeare fans, or like how are I'm curious about the reception here.
Yeah, well, for sure. Absolutely. If I go into the terrain of stepping foot amongst what's called, so for those who don't know, the individuals who or the people who consider that the man from Stratford, William Shakespeare, was the true author of the plays and poetry with the name William Shakespeare on them, they're called Stratfordians. So these are the majority of academics. These are the majority of stage and film directors. These are the majority of actors. This is just, the majority. It's the mainstream. So whenever I've entered upon that in the past or now in the present, with this book, for example, if I go online and if I go to different Shakespeare Facebook groups or if I interact with other people in different ways online, it is where you're definitely entering a terrain where people can get very hostile. So the controversy with this is definitely there. I think that the thing is that we live in a time where there's still most people believe in religion. I think and if you were to ask most people on this planet, they have one religion or another. But for the most part, our society, our culture is basically very consumer materialistic. And so people's concerns and thoughts are not on religion. And so because of this, it's almost like not even really that controversial to be critical of religious figures anymore, just because of the lack of faith and lack of belief in these religions. So what you have instead is you have the same need to hang on to certain idols or icons of culture that mean something to people. And so, for people who are into literature, into theater, and of course into Shakespeare, one of these icons or one of these idols is William Shakespeare. So, if you threaten that idol, if you make any kind of alternative perspective on this work, the Shakespeare canon, as it's called, basically all the plays and poetry with Shakespeare's name on them are called Shakespeare canon. They take it as a threat, and they get very personal. And it can get quite hostile, and it gets to the point where they make personal attacks. They question your sanity. They question all kinds of things, and it obviously it's people get very touchy when it comes to this, and they won't let up. I mean, there have been a number of times where I tried to kind of like de-escalate the conflict with people about this, but it just keeps on escalating, and then it gets to a point where I get really upset, and I have to just disconnect myself from these individuals and their hostility. There was one time a number of years ago where there was a prominent Shakespeare scholar who was in town and here in Los Angeles, and he was giving a talk with another person, an actress, and they were talking about the subversive element to Shakespeare's plays. And there was a Q&A open to discussion after the lecture, and I put out there, and this is a prominent Shakespeare scholar who loves to put down anybody who's what would be called anti-Stratfordians. So he anti-Stratfordian is anyone basically doesn't believe that it was William Shakespeare from
Okay, so you're
Stratford.
in the enemy camp here, then, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely. Well, so here's the thing though, for me, I think what, I think is a point important for people to understand is that, I've been involved in this, that what's called the Shakespeare authorship question for 30 years, and heavily invested in this. And I've changed my mind many times. I've been in one camp or another, whether it would be believing it was William Shakespeare or Edward de Vere, the Earl of Oxford, or Christopher Marlowe, or Francis Bacon, or William Stanley, or and so on and so on. So I've changed my mind over the decades quite a lot. And what I've noticed is that t people tend to stay in one camp. So they'll pick one person and stick there. And I'm one of those rare birds that actually changes their mind. And what I found is that a lot of the people who are in these other camps, I think they're just a little bit slightly more open-minded, but they also too can get very personal, and they hang on to their personal favorite or their theory. And so what it is for me is, I think it's the Shakespeare authorship question is a opportunity for people to explore, I think, the aspects of being dogmatically attached to a theory. Without having 100% proof. No one really has 100% proof. So I think that one of the things that has kind of unsettled people in terms of what I'm doing is that, I presented a book last year, Anonymous Agnostic Antichrist, which shows that Thomas North and a number of other authors were the true authors of the Shakespeare canon. But later this year, I'm going to be presenting a different version of the story, which is called Mr. W.H. And this is going to be presenting Anthony Bacon, Francis Bacon's older brother, as the true author of the plays and poetry. So this is, I think it's hard for me to find. I've never come across anybody who has been willing to accept multiple theories as possibilities. But I think this is a perfect example where we can, because no one has 100% proof of any of these theories. You can make a good argument for any of them, and there's also problems with all of them too.
Yeah, I think that's really insightful, and I think that you're kind of doing a little bit of a service to history in this, in that, like, you're kind of looking at it as something worth investigating, not something like written in stone that's like dates that you have to memorize. You know, it's something that's still kind of living and alive, and you can interact with it and learn from it that way.
I think it's an interesting perspective just into kind of human nature, like.
Yeah, and I think that you had some good insight too about, you know, our sort of psychological infrastructure surrounding religion. And I know Nietzsche kind of talked about this a little bit in, like, Zarathustra, right? Like, about God is dead and we've killed him and what are we going to do now? You know, right? So yeah, very, very insightful.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a human need for idol worship, regardless if it has a religious nature or not. And I think you can see that with athletes and celebrities and whatnot, is the motivation to worship something and hang on to something is extremely still very, very much in our genes, it seems, and so it's just I think the Shakespeare authorship question is I think the problem is that people are so personally attached to these plays and poetry, and they should be, because they're beautiful. I mean, they really are, in many ways, I mean, arguably the greatest works of creative art, in a new genre. And it's just a massive body of work. You're looking at between 37 and 40 plays, two narrative poems, 154 sonnets. So it's just this big, massive body of work that is just like one masterpiece after another. And so it means a lot to people. It means an enormous amount to me, a huge amount to me. And I think it's just a lot more comforting to just be more certain about it, and just to feel like, okay, well, these plays are so amazing, are these greatest works of art, and I need to know who it was that created them. And I have that need too. Like I wish in the last 30 years I came across something that was like undeniable proof. I've come across things that have seemed to be so, and the Thomas North theory is a very strong very strong theory, but it's got some problems with it too. And so it's just I think it's worth looking into for people. I think people should take a look into this and dive in and jump into this rabbit hole, because you'll find all kinds of just fascinating things.
Well, I
So, and
think
then
it's
not.
just, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was just going to kind of comment on just how fascinating this ownership or authorship question actually is. And like, do we see this anywhere else in the arts or in literature?
Well,
And to have such
Homer
a, like
is
a.
one example. Like Homer, the play, you know, poems of Homer. We think that Homer might just mean like poet, right? I'm
Yeah,
not an
and that's, but
expert in
that's
this, but
one
yeah.
work, right? It's just one work that was an oral tradition that was eventually
Wait, wait.
recorded.
Yeah, two. Well, there's the Iliad and the
Iliad, the
Odyssey.
Odyssey, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
But the,
but
yeah.
yeah, no, that it. Well, I think you make a good point. I think in terms of, yeah, I mean, but you, I mean, Lux is right too. There is some question as whether Homer was just like a figure that was just put on the name on it, and it was actually maybe a verbal story that was being told for
Oh, absolutely,
generations.
yeah.
And so
But
maybe
just
that's too.
the sheer breadth of the work. You just mentioned hundreds of sonnets, all and these are not these are masterpieces, one after the other, you know, like, so
Exactly.
I
Yeah,
think
no, you're, yeah.
it really is. If you kind of look at the history of art as a whole, is there any artist that could compare to like this breadth of work?
No, I can't, you know, and I love many different kinds of art. Like, I love painting. I love Picasso's art. You know, I love Van Gogh's art, Modigliani, just, you know, Leonardo da Vinci. Da Vinci's art, you know, what he did. And then you can look at, also in terms of music, you can look at Beethoven or Bach or Mozart, and just look at, or in novels, maybe Dostoevsky or many others, of course. But it's just in terms of the breadth of expression, just in terms of not just only in genre, from comedies to histories to tragedies to romances and whatnot. You're looking at like, there's so many characters. There's an enormous amount of characters that are complex and multidimensional, just from just so many, from Hamlet to Falstaff to Macbeth to Othello to Juliet to Rosalind to Viola to I mean, this list goes on and on, of just these, to Iago, to Richard III, to Richard II, just like, almost every play has some kind of fascinating personality that you know art had never saw before these works, and there's been some great works of art afterwards, but really, it's really hard to say anything has kind of come close to it. And I think one of the problems that I had when I was writing the first book, Anonymous Agnostic Antichrist, was that the theory behind that one was that it was a group of writers. So that was one of the theories I struggled with throughout my life, was it seeing these plays being written by a number of different people, simply because it was just, I mean, certainly there are examples of where groups of people coming together create great works of art, absolutely. But there's definitely a variety in terms of personal expression, like the vision, artistic vision that's being expressed. And what one finds with the Shakespeare canon is that despite all these different characters and all these different stories, you find the same themes popping up. You find a lot of the way the characters express themselves, that the way that the stories develop. There's a lot of consistencies from one play to the next, and over a period of decades, that it seems like it has like one voice that's kind of like working through it. And so it, yeah, it's just it is just, it's really hard to find, you know, anywhere in history where you have this big, massive body of work that could be questionable in terms of who created it. I can't think of anything. I mean, when we're talking about religion, I think there's definitely, one can make a really good case that it's you know, not only Homer might be a fictional character, but you know, Jesus Christ might be actually fictional, or Buddha, or even Abraham, you know. And it's really hard to find, like, in terms of the measure of historical people, individuals like those three, it's hard to find the proof for it. So I think it's just like, it certainly are, there are examples of where the story we're told is probably not true. And I think this is definitely one of those cases. I think the mystery, though, the really, really the big mystery is that if it wasn't Shakespeare, then who, not only who was it, but well, why did it come to be and be passed down to us as Shakespeare? That's where the big mystery is, you know. And some people just think, well, maybe it was just an accident. Other people say it was a big conspiracy involved. I think that one has to find out for themselves, or just leave it open to just questioning, which I think is healthy to do, as to why, if it wasn't Shakespeare, why it was someone else, and why did they use Shakespeare's name? But yeah, I don't think that there really is any other examples in an art where there was a big, massive body of work. You can see maybe a couple of works of art, like a couple of books, a couple of paintings, or a couple of pieces of music. But like again, 37 to 40 plays, 154 sonnets, two narrative poems, you know, possibly even more. So that was all created and done in this way. Yeah, there's no other example that I can think of.
Very interesting. Yeah, and controversial, right? Like when we're talking about art, people are going to, of course, have opinions about this stuff and everything. But yeah, I think you make some really solid points there about just the just sheer volume of this stuff there and everything. When we spoke for my show Lux Cult, you shared a little bit about how you felt that this work, whether it was created by one person or a group of people, but it really was sort of revolutionary in terms of how people experienced narrative, in terms of like where these narratives were taking place, like in the scale of like on the gods in humans' life, you know. And I remember you saying something that really stuck with me about how the work really brought like personality into, you know, just the entertainment in itself. Like it's sort of like put a more human face on things, I think is how you put it. Could you comment a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. This was actually this theme or this idea was what kind of like has really was one of the bigger motivations to create these works. And so what it is that it's something that struck me a long time ago. And when I came across this, there's a Shakespeare scholar by the name of Harold Bloom, and he wrote a book called The Invention of the Human. And his theory was that like the idea of what it means to be a human being was literally invented with the Shakespeare canon. And he gave examples of it. You know, he gave examples of Juliet in terms of how revolutionary her character was in opposition to other female characters in romances, in terms of how she her pursuit of genuine expression or expression of genuine feeling. And way she does it, and the way she teaches Romeo in this way was truly revolutionary. And then also you have just so many other characters where he gives examples of why in the Shakespeare canon you see this idea that human beings were basically not obviously invented. All these different experiences had already existed, but there was never before had anyone put to put human beings at center stage. Like you can always look back and look and before the Shakespeare canon, there was music, or there was plays, or there was paintings, or there were stories where people were obviously very important to all of these different forms of art and different expressions. But it was always the human beings always played a secondary role, not only to religion, and this is not just in terms of monotheistic religions, but also to the pagan religions prior, where everything was sort of in service to not just religious ideas, but also you know, notions of the state. Or even if you look in Roman times, where there was a lot of focus on how to live, like in terms of ethics or virtues, or in a civil society, in terms of was focusing on people per se, but it was people in terms of how do they find their place in the social setting in the world. And that of course is fascinating, but again it's kind of putting the human experience secondary. And so one of the things that I came across too in researching over the years was this quote by Friedrich Nietzsche. And Nietzsche said that the greatest reader of this French philosopher Montaigne, Michel Ecouen Montaigne, who was in the 16th century. The greatest reader of Montaigne was Shakespeare. And it struck me, and I was like, I wonder what does he mean by that? And then I started to dive into this more. And so Montaigne wrote, his great work was this thing called the Essays. And so the subject matter of the Essays was himself. And at the time, a lot of people were very critical, made fun of him. Montaigne is like, what the hell are you doing? And this book, the Essays, is massive. It's huge. It's bigger than the Bible. And so if you were like, it would take forever to read, right? And the subject matter is just him. It's just Montaigne himself. And like, honestly, nobody did that before. Like that was truly revolutionary. And so for me, the connection between Montaigne and Shakespeare is extremely important. And I think what Shakespeare did was, rather than just focus on one person, so himself, right? Montaigne basically focused on himself. Shakespeare then expanded that idea of focusing attention on the self, on the human being, to all of humanity. So all of these different characters, this wide range of characters, women and men, all these different people, and all these different scenarios, and all these different stories, making them the center of attention, and all of their complexity. And I think, like the most famous speech in all of Shakespeare, which people, everyone knows, even if they're not into Shakespeare, is "To be or not to be." So now that speech right there, "To be or not to be," by Hamlet in the play Hamlet, is a perfect example of this, because it takes the question of whether life is living worth living or not, and it never provides a spiritual answer. It never provides a political answer. It never provides any answer. It just leaves it out there as a question. And Hamlet explores this in his mind, and he in a soliloquy to the audience. And it's extremely striking, because it's just like, here's this person who's basically telling the audience whether life is worth living or not, and giving you reasons for it not being worth living for, and reasons to live for. And so it's just that kind of exploration was very radical. And so this was what really fascinated me, and I really wanted to explore in these characters, was just that if whoever it was who created this was in many ways a revolutionary. And I think it's important for us, when we look back at the Shakespeare canon, how much of modern times has been enormously influenced by these works, because in many ways we are the children of this way of looking at the world, at ourselves, and even having, and back then it was the audacity to consider giving yourself that much attention, or people that much attention. And now it's just the norm. We all just give ourselves so much attention. It's a normal thing. But back then it was very much a revolutionary, radical way, and paving the way for the rest of us.
Yeah, that's wild. Imagine what those people back then would think of social media, right?
Right.
It is really interesting, because if you look at the Middle Ages and just kind of the other works of the previous era before the Renaissance, and we got Dante, and it's basically them descending into the afterlife, where the world's not even real. So it's very kind of supernatural. And I think the other really famous one was a play called Everyman, where someone is ascending the ladder back up to heaven, and they're kind of losing their individuality and kind of going back to the source.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of morality plays. There were like Everyman plays, if I recall correctly, that these were sort of like these, tales for how to like live as a working class person, if I recall correctly. I'm definitely not an expert in this, so please
Well,
take what I've said with salt.
it
But
just
yes.
seems like the like kind of the maybe the thrust of the society or the civilization was very much concerned, maybe with these kind of otherworldly or afterlife, or had a view of reality that was fundamentally, different than how we see things today. But it seems like with Shakespeare, where we're starting to move into the human experience, away from kind of these otherworldly aspects that we don't really know about, we can think about, into things we actually can experience. And it's kind of an interesting shift. And I think maybe, I don't know if that's caused by Shakespeare, or he's just kind of an element of the times that brings this into art.
Yeah, I think it's definitely you when we look at the Renaissance, it's the humanist tradition, right? The humanist tradition started in Italy, and then the Renaissance itself started first in Italy, then spread throughout. And so the English Renaissance, which was during Shakespeare's time, came much later. So you think when you look at all the different artists and writers and thinkers that came during the Italian Renaissance, there was just so much brilliance, and rightly deserving of all the attention it's gotten over the centuries. It's just beautiful. Everything that's expressed, from Michelangelo's paintings to Da Vinci's paintings and inventions and to all kinds of other things. There's also other people too that are lesser known today who are very radical and extremely important. There's one of my favorites is this guy who was actually quite popular in England during Shakespeare's time. A lot of authors liked him, was Pietro Aretino. And Aretino wrote in a very realistic, he wrote plays, and he also wrote other stuff too, but and he was very scandalous. He was very out there in terms of his sexuality. He was very publicly declared himself homosexual. And he had an affair with a woman one time, and he said that he declared it happened because he had a fit of some kind of illness. He was like ill, and that was why he suddenly found himself attracted to women. And
What a
so
firebrand.
he was very. And so what's interesting is that when we look back at history, we a lot of times we think of things were just very very prim and proper, but there's a lot of examples. If you look back and you look hard enough, you'll find all kinds of just colorful characters who were anything but prim and proper. And Aretino was definitely one of them. And he talked about prostitutes and crooks and thieves and pimps and then he also talked about he was very critical of the most powerful people at the time, even critical of popes. And he had the protection though, so he was almost killed a couple of times. There was people tried to kill him. He was on the run, and he went to he lived in Venice for the last, I think, 20 or 30 years of his life, and he was under the protection of the very powerful merchant families there in Venice, who were fine with him because he was making fun of their enemies. So as long as he wasn't making fun of them, then he can go ahead and say all kinds of bad stuff about these religious figures and so forth. But so I think, but you had, so what I bring him up because if you look at his works, and this was like in the early 1500s, right? A number of decades before Shakespeare's play, you see this very, very strong tendency for realism to show people as they are and to show human beings as they are. But it's done in a kind of this very cynical way. And so Aretino kind of just wants to show you, but in a very entertaining way. He's an excellent writer. He shows you like all this very like scandalous aspect of what it means to be a human being. And so he was doing it in kind of this like shocking expose kind of way, almost like a gossip magazine or something, and this, so there's just a lot of examples prior to Shakespeare that took place, especially in Italy, that did definitely pave the way for the Shakespeare canon to come into existence. It definitely, it didn't come out of thin air. There was definitely a lot of examples that came before. I mean, Montaigne, of course, is being to me the biggest one. So I think it was radical and revolutionary because there really wasn't anything like it before. But there was examples that inspired, I think, the Shakespeare canon to come into being as it did. And also too, you mentioned Dante earlier, who was in the 13th, 14th century, and he definitely with the Divine Comedy, while it is very much obsessed with spirituality, and that is the center, there is a little something radical about what Dante did too, because he decided to, while he's talking about God, he's talking about punishment and all these different and rewarding and all these different things, right? All these different religious notions. There is this interest in himself as and in terms of who he is.
He put
And
some of his political rivals in hell and stuff.
yeah, I know. Yeah,
Oh, and he's
he
guided
did.
by a pagan, so I think that might have been a little bit controversial too.
That's right. Yeah, it's a pagan figure. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, well, that was the reason why Virgil couldn't join him in paradise, though. Virgil, at once they get to the end of purgatory, Dante had to say, "Well, sorry, Virgil, you can't join me up here because you're a pagan." Bye.
That sucks.
And so, but yeah, I definitely think you can look back before Shakespeare. You can see examples, like little bits here and there, where people were like taking interest in themselves, and I think that the Renaissance was definitely a great opportunity for this to happen. Like there was a whole culture that was being created a good 100 years or more prior to Shakespeare's plays that laid the foundation for these plays to really come into existence. And I think when they did, because they're coming again, they're coming into the form of plays. So in the 1590s and 1600s and around that period of time, this English Renaissance is happening, and it's all happening through language, through words, and it's all spoken words in terms of plays. And the modern English language is being created. Like so much of the words that we use today, the phrases we use today, started at this period and during the English Renaissance. So it was language that was really the radical thing. But it comes through in the form of theater. And at that time, theater was not considered a high art form. It was definitely very much a low art form and very kind of like not highly regarded. Well, I can't say at all, but it was definitely something that people didn't really like to want to be proud associating with, right? And so I think it kind of caught people off guard. So definitely the plays and poetry with Shakespeare's name on them were popular at the time and people loved them. And I think people could see that they were really quite something different. But because it came through in that form, and then the poetry came through in erotic poetry. So it's important to know that the first two examples of Shakespeare's name on them came through in highly sexually charged poetry, in Venus and Adonis, which is about the goddess Venus, who is lusting after this young teenager, basically, who's a hunter named Adonis, who has no interest
Problematic.
in. And so it just filled with sex, like from beginning to end. And then the next narrative poem is also about sex, but it's very dark. It's a much darker version of it, and it's about a rape that takes place, and it's called The Rape of Lucrece. And so it and goes into the mind frame of this rapist, and who happens to be Tarquin, who was so his family were like the last kings of Rome. And because of what would all the well, not only just the rape of Lucrece, but all these other corruption that they did, there was a group of people, of Romans, that decided to overthrow the Tarquin family and establish the Roman Republic. So it was just a so what I'm saying is, though, is that these great works of art, and then the sonnets are filled with most of them are homoerotic love poems, one man to another. And then the love poems are from a man to a woman who is a dark lady who he describes as being dark of skin, who was probably of African. He described her hair in such a way that so it's a love for another man and love for a black woman. So it and all these different examples of Shakespeare at the time were not like it was just it was it was it
Subversive,
was
yeah.
very subversive, extremely subversive. So it I think it really did catch people off guard, and they didn't really know what quite to make of it, And it what's interesting is that when people say like, "Well, when did the Shakespeare authorship question start?" and they say, "Oh, well, it was started in the early or no mid 1800s with people who believed it was Francis Bacon," and I say, "Well, actually, no, it happened at the time." So there were people at the time who actually questioned Shakespeare's authorship. And one of them was, or two of them were actually these two poets named John Marston and Joseph Hall. Marston was a fan of romantic poetry, and Hall was, he hated romantic poetry. And so they used Shakespeare's poems as examples of what one loved and what the other hated. And so they basically used it, and they referred to the author as labeo. And labeo was in those what it means in Latin is thick-lipped, and what one of the interesting things about that is that if you look at portraits of Anthony Bacon, and especially his father Nicholas Bacon, is that they have these humongous lips, enormous lips, and then as they're going back and forth and they're quoting the Venus and Adonis line by line, and then one saying he loves it, the other one saying he hates it, and then they actually put the Bacon family motto that Anthony and Francis Bacon had, mediocre firma, which means to proceed in moderation. And so it was very like, here it is in the 1590s, late 1590s, these two guys are saying, that one hates it and says this is vomit, this is throw up. And the only reason, why this person decides to give it to the public is so he could put another man's name on it. And so that, this is just horrible, just romantic garbage, and that's the whole character. But I think that, yeah, just that, this is coming. So all these works coming to us in this very subversive, scandalous kind of form, and plays and sex poetry, basically. So I don't think people at the time really understood just how enormously revolutionary it was because of how it was coming to people.
And I can understand now, with this context a little bit more, is why there is this authorship question, right? This is subversive stuff. This is stuff that maybe could have gotten you in trouble to have your name on it or whatever. So that makes a lot of sense.
And that kind of continues through a lot of his works as they go, right? Because I know some of the political works were kind of, I don't know, aimed at the English throne.
Absolutely. So there's this one play called Richard II, and Elizabeth forbade anybody to write and publish or even discuss that person in particular, Richard II, because it was seen that she was Richard II. And so what happened was Richard II was a king who basically he abdicated his crown to Richard Bolingbroke, or not Richard Bolingbroke, Henry Bolingbroke, who became Henry IV, and then his son became Henry V, and his son became Henry VI, and then there was Henry the Se well Richard III, and then Henry VII, and Henry VIII, and then so forth and so forth. But basically, this play came out, and the first published version of it, anyway, was in 1597, and then later on, in 1600, there was this guy named the Earl of Essex. The Earl of Essex actually was. Did he wanted to what seems to be still a little bit gray as to what he was trying to do, but was to do an overthrow the queen, or at least her advisors, and did a military coup. So he had these actors, Shakespeare's company, perform this play, Richard II, to incite a riot. So basically they put this play, Richard II, and they performed it, and then thereafter they took to the streets to basically in military. There was going to be a military coup, overthrow of Queen Elizabeth.
Wow.
And so, yeah. And so it was one of the plays was actually used for as a revolutionary act. And the odd thing about it is that Shakespeare was never punished for writing this play, and the actors who performed the play were never punished either. And so there's a lot of just under mystery involved in terms of what may have happened. And there's a lot of, I mean, and for me, knowing the Thomas North theory, I have some explanations for it. And the main guy behind the Thomas North theory, Dennis McCarthy, he has explanations for why it happened the way it did. And I certainly can't feel that there's a strong case to be made that it was Anthony Bacon who was behind it, and that he was punished for it, because he's disappears in 1600. Anthony Bacon happened to be the Earl of Essex' right-hand man, by the way. There was nobody closer to the Earl of Essex than Anthony Bacon. And he was there up until the end as his main person. And he was in charge of intelligence work. He was the head of espionage, the head spy master at the time for Essex. And suddenly in 1600, he disappears. There's no record of his death. And then just a year later, his brother Francis Bacon mentions that he was dead, but nobody, there's no record of where he died, what he died from. He just suddenly disappears.
So this is fascinating. This almost sounds like a sort of like adjacent to like almost like a psyop or something that this intelligence person that was into this intelligence community of the time have, constructed this play that has this political message and, outcome that they're wanting to have with it. That's fascinating.
Absolutely. Something happened. So Essex definitely wanted to shake things up by using the play, because and the Queen Elizabeth acknowledged that she there's a record of a dialogue between her and Francis Bacon, who was very close to her and her legal team in the case against Essex and his followers. And all these followers were brought to trial, except for Anthony Bacon. Like, we don't know. It's like a mystery. Where did he go?
Yeah, it really
But his brother.
underlines the power of art too for me. Gosh, that's really wild.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, she, you know, one of the reasons I think that, you know, for so long, a lot of, you know, plays and poetry were written anonymously, like had no names attached to it, was because the artists, the writers knew how dangerous it was. They knew that it would piss off people in power. And so they were very careful. They didn't want to have their names associated with these works. It was also a social thing too, where they looked down at it. Like, you, if you were to put your name on these works, it would be like, it would be just, you would be seen as a, just, it was a, the cultural norm at the time was that was just not something you did. You didn't put your name to works of poetry even, let alone plays. And so, but by the 1590s, you suddenly see these writers' names on plays and on poetry. There's just this a big, just explosion of it. And I think one of the reasons, it wasn't the only reason, but one of the reasons was that the people in power, from Queen Elizabeth and to her men and the Privy Council, that they wanted to be able to know who was writing what, so they could punish the appropriate person. And you know,
Makes sense.
it was, it, yeah. So I think a lot of the reason why we have authors' names in England anyway came about because the authorities wanted to know who wrote what for sure.
Fascinating.
That's so interesting. So counter to what you would initially assume.
Yeah, so this is fascinating stuff. I'm hoping that you wouldn't mind kind of telling us a little bit about how your thinking has changed about the story with this new work that you're doing for this new book.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, it kind of struck me, you know, in the beginning of this year, you know, and I still feel that there's a strong possibility that it was Thomas North and these other authors. But what struck me was that earlier this year, I even before writing Anonymous Agnostic Antichrist, I actually had the idea of it being about Anthony Bacon. So Anthony Bacon has definitely been, for a number of years, somebody in recent years, somebody who I've really felt strongly as being the possible true person. But it did strike me earlier this year that there, it just, again, the thing that has always kind of struck me throughout my life was that the singularity of expression from play to play and from poem to poem, and that it really, I mean, it really did just seem to be coming, like, I definitely think there was collaboration going on for sure. But there really, it seemed to be that it was, say, one person. And as much as I love Thomas North, and I love, I think what the, so he's known for these translations. He was known mostly for this translation published in 1580 called Plutarch's Lives. And so it's Plutarch was a Roman historian who basically he wrote this work called his Lives, right, of these noble Romans and Grecians. And he compared them, their lives, one to the other. That could be a famous, like, you know, Julius Caesar, or Coriolanus, or Timon of Athens, and Antony, Mark Antony, and Cleopatra, and just would go into their lives and into the personal stories. And so Thomas North translated not from the original Latin, but from the French version by this guy named Amiot, and I might be pronouncing his name wrong, but anyway, he was a translator. And so there's definitely examples of some remarkable writing in Thomas North's translations. He was quite a bit older too, and I just, you know, that's the reason why I had to have other writers help Thomas North with the writing of the plays. He died probably no later than 1607 or 1608, and there definitely was somebody involved in the writing of the first folio, the first collection of Shakespeare's plays in 1623. And so it couldn't have been Thomas North. He would have been dead by that point. So I believe it was like these other people helping him to write these plays after he died. And then he collaborated with people before he died too, while he was alive, for decades. But I just came across just like this, again, just the thing that struck me was that it just seemed to be something that took place in the chronology. I just had an issue with the chronology of it, and then in terms of where it seemed like there's this distinct voice coming out in the 1580s, especially late 1580s, and definitely by the early to mid 1590s that we know as Shakespeare. And so it there are some things you can see coming before that for decades that can connect to the language of Shakespeare, but there just seems to be this really distinct and powerful voice that comes out at this time, and that it continues until the 1623 First Folio. And so I just thought, well, maybe it was somebody else. Maybe it really wasn't Thomas North and these other people. Maybe it was this one person who was this enormous genius that, did collaborate with others, but it was ultimately their expression, their work, And so then I thought, well, I still like this other book that I just written. And so I thought, well, what about, and I remembered as a teenager that there was this Japanese film called Rashomon by Akira Kurosawa. And the movie is fantastic. It's a masterpiece. And it's a very simple film, actually, but it takes place during medieval Japan. And the action is this wife and her husband are traveling through the forest, and they get ambushed and robbed by a bandit. And so the story is told from four different perspectives: from the wife's perspective, from the husband's perspective, from the bandit's perspective, and from a witness. So it was an eyewitness who watched it all. So all four of their perspectives are being told, and we see it, cinematically. And I always thought to myself, like, I always wanted to do something similar to that, like tell the same story, but in a completely different way, from a completely different perspective. So I thought, well, why not do that with this? Like the Shakespeare authorship question presents itself in a way where it really can lead to different possibilities, because again, I don't really think anyone has been able to prove it 100% for anybody. If you go on Wikipedia, there's like over 80 different candidates for the authorship question that have been proposed over the centuries, and there's even more possibilities beyond that, I think. But so you have us all these different possibilities, and I thought, okay, I had originally wanted to do the story about Anthony Bacon, like back in 2022. So why not do it about him and just have the story be told from him, his perspective, and how he created the Shakespeare canon. And so that's what I'm currently working on right now, and will continue to work on, and it'll come out in December, December 5th. So December 5th will be the 1 year anniversary of when Anonymous Agnostic Antichrist came out last year. And that came out on the 400th anniversary of the publication of the First Folio. We don't have an actual publication date, but we do have a record of the first sale. And so that was on December 5th of 1623. And so I wanted to publish Anonymous Agnostic Antichrist last year on the 400th anniversary. And so now this book will be published a year later from that publication. And so yeah, I think it wouldn't let me go. Like I as much as I want to continue, I have other stories I want to tell, and I have another project I'm working on. I really felt it was something just haunting me the earlier this year that was just telling me that I'm not done with this, that I still had more to explore, and that it would be an opportunity to present a different version of the story. And so that, yeah, and that's what I'm doing.
Right on. Very cool.
Sounds very interesting. And so this new candidate, this is the brother of Francis Bacon, the philosopher.
Yes. And so what's interesting to know, going back to the Montaigne, so the French philosopher Montaigne, he for people who don't know, he was enormously influential, but it didn't happen like overnight. So his works weren't translated into English until the early 1600s by John Florio. And that, again, it took a while for it to kind of like seep into the consciousness of people in Europe. But it was some there was certain degree of recognizability, and Montaigne was somewhat of a celebrity. He was actually more known as a statesman. But so people have often remarked how much of an influence Montaigne has had on Francis Bacon, and there's no doubt about it. So what's interesting is that in the first version of Francis Bacon's essays, so he wrote his own essays, came out in the mid 1590s, I think 1596, 1597, around that time. And Francis Bacon dedicated that his essays to his brother Anthony. He loved his older brother. It was a complicated relationship, I'm sure. Well, I know it was, but he dedicated that publication to his brother Anthony. He called him his comforter, and he thanked Anthony for introducing Montaigne to him. So the last letter that Montaigne read was from Anthony Bacon. So Anthony Bacon, he lived in France throughout the 1580s and was friends with Montaigne. He was a very close friend, and Montaigne's executor was this French poet named Pierre Braque. And Braque looked up to Anthony Bacon enormously, and he considered Anthony Bacon a better poet than himself. And in letters to Anthony Bacon, he was always holding him in high regard. And in letters from Montaigne to Anthony Bacon, Montaigne held Anthony Bacon in enormously high regard, which is saying a lot coming from Montaigne. And it just, you get a sense that here was this guy, Anthony Bacon, who was very mysterious, and got into some trouble throughout different points of his life. And yet he was involved in during his adult years in espionage. And so he never made an appearance at Elizabeth's court. She was constantly asking for him to show up at her court, and he would always say he had one illness after another, so he never actually showed up at her court. So he was this very powerful figure, highly regarded by, like people that, Francis Bacon looked up, his younger brother looked up to him, Montaigne looked up to him, this other French poet, Pierre Braque, looked up to him. So here was this guy who must have had this amazing intellect and talent. And yet we have no poems by him. We have nothing. We just have letters by him, which are do show what's interesting about him is that he has this enormous empathy for other people. So he wrote letters to various different people he knew. You could show that he had a lot of affection for people. He was very intelligent and very articulate. But here was this guy. Yeah, he was just sort of in the shadows, and he lived right next to the theater. So throughout the 1590s, where he lived was not at the family home. He took up a residence right next to the theater where the plays were being performed. And he was just at the center of so much that we regard as being important to the creation of the Shakespeare plays. He was Essex's right-hand man. He was right there. He was most likely probably madly in love with the Earl of Southampton, who was also right there next to Essex as well. And so the dedication to the Earl of Southampton, the Venus and Adonis and the Rape of Lucrece, makes a lot of sense if it was written from Anthony Bacon, because he was right there with the Earl of Southampton and with Essex. So he was just this fascinating person to me. And I just it made a lot of sense. Again, it's a possibility. It may not be true, but I feel like there's definitely a strong case to be made for Anthony Bacon.
It's fascinating. Yeah, this whole story, there's so much intrigue and mystery tied up to it. Espionage has been brought up several times.
I
What
can
is
see
going
how you
on
like it. Yeah.
in England at this time? Like, what's the political climate? Is this unstable? Is like what's the kind of deal on the ground?
Well, sure. So in the book that Luxa has, Anonymous Agnostic Antichrist, it explores the different secret societies that were involved at the time. So, and I created them. The names I give them are not. They're not factual, they're not historical. Again, these books that I'm writing are novels. They're fiction, the works of fiction. So they're not work. They're not trying to present it as fact. But I do truly do strongly believe that there were people behind the scenes influencing events that were taking place. And I do feel strongly that there were people who were of a progressive nature who wanted to change things and who were very much against the establishment of religion. And so really wanted to push forward different ways of thinking, new ways of thinking, new ways of living. And I definitely think that they had a role in terms of I think protecting whoever it was, whether it was Thomas North and his collaborators, or if it was Anthony Bacon, whoever it was, or other people, whoever it was, that definitely I think had some degree of protection. So that there was definitely people, powerful people behind the scenes. That I don't think it was like it, I don't think it was people who were, say, dogmatically Protestant or dogmatically Catholic, right? The great political conflict during the 16th century was between Catholicism, the old religion, the old Christianity, right? Rome's religion, and all the various different schisms that took place, all the different Christianities that sprung out after Luther. So you have Luther, and then you have also, of course, Henry VIII starting the Church of England, and you have Calvin, and you have the Presbyterians, and you have the Puritans. You just have all these different offshoots and fighting against each other. But rather than it being, I think the real kind of conflict that was going on was a more secretive nature, and that there was a number of people who were trying to create a new reality, and who were trying to create a new society. And in many ways they succeeded. So we have a lot of negative, horrible things going on, perhaps the results of the work that they did. But and then other new people, new forces that taking over as well, of course. But I think if you go back in those times, really like the seeds of the Enlightenment were happening at this time. You really have like the seeds of free thinking were happening at this time. It was very brave. There's a lot of conservatism. And so there's a lot of just like stiff structure, social structures that you just were almost impossible to break out of. But given within those strict confines, I think that you find that there was a lot of people who were trying to change things in radical ways. You know, one of them is in that book, Anonymous Agnostic Antichrist, which is it goes into in the last few chapters this woman by the name of Emilie Lanier. Now, Emilie Lanier is a very important historical figure that has gotten more attention in recent decades. She first started being considered as the Dark Lady of Shakespeare's sonnets, but she actually wrote some stuff on her own right outside of anything to do with Shakespeare. And she published this work of poetry in 1611, and it was in Latin, and I can't pronounce the name, but basically it took the theme that women were equal to men. And that it started at the very beginning with Adam and Eve, and that there was a problem with
Very subversive idea. Honestly, still these days, it's a subversive idea.
absolutely, yeah. You know, can you imagine? So she, and what's even more radical, if you can imagine, you have to, I mean, so gender conflict was very heightened in those days. There was, and I go into that in the last few chapters in terms of the different characters on both sides. There was other women who followed Emilie Lanier. There was other women that came before her too, like Mary Sidney, Philip Sidney's sister, who was a poet herself and a very important figure, were very radical. And but we have to understand. So Emilie Lanier published this book of poetry, saying that Adam was just as much to blame for the fall of man as Eve. And that, and she even argued it, not like extremely explicit, but she definitely makes a case for it that women are actually superior to men. And so she's doing this in 1611, which, if people know, this is when King James published his King James Bible. The King James Bible is very misogynistic in a lot of ways, because King James himself was extremely misogynistic. He actually wrote a book, or he had other people write it for him. I think it was called Witches, and he argued that all women were inherently witches, and he had a deep anxiety about anything to do with witchcraft and anything to do with magic. He was very much against any of that stuff. Because he felt his life was threatened a number of times, including his wife's life a number of times because of witchcraft. So
And
he
this
was
is
very
the
much
guy who wrote our current Bible.
exactly. Yes, he King James in many ways shaped so much of modern. Yeah,
Was
there's
he
so
involved
much
with
that.
the whole Hammer of Witches crew? Was that part of the story? They wrote that book, The Hammer of Witches, about like how to
I think
torture
that was
people,
some German
basically.
dude.
Okay.
We actually had that book at my work. It came through.
Yeah,
Yeah,
he. Well,
how
yeah,
to
he.
find witches.
Yeah, well, there's the that one, The Discovery of Witches, by Reginald Scott, which was a it, it basically, it's a great book too, because there's so much details in there that historians have found to be actually very accurate. So Reginald Scott did a lot of research on that, for sure. But yeah, for going back to Miliania, you know, it's just in terms of how radical she was, just that, you know, at the time that she published this work, And she dedicated the book to all these different women at the time, these prominent women at the time. She didn't dedicate it to any men. It was all women. And again, this is 1611.
Is
So it
she
just,
in France or is this in England?
this is England. Yeah,
Okay.
she was in England. So right in, at the height of her poetic talents is at, right at the time when the King James Bible was being published. So you you really have, she's really putting herself out there, and it's just it. There's a yeah. There's a lot going on. Like, and I think in terms of race too. Like, if we were looking at race, that people don't know. So people know, of course, 1619 is when the slave trade really took into full effect from England. That's the date, you know, in 1619, and when King James is in power. And what's interesting is that the play Othello is first published in 1622, which again people need to know that 1622 is 6 years after Shakespeare died, and it's also a long time after a lot of other you know Shakespeare authorship question candidates died too. So somebody was working on it and published in 1622. And the name James, but in Spanish, is Iago. So the character of Iago, who is this horrible villain, is shares the name with King James, and Othello is being portrayed in this very sympathetic
How far
light.
ahead of its time was that work? Jesus.
Absolutely, you know, and race is a common thing throughout the Shakespeare plays, and again, was very different from other plays at the time, like The Merchant of Venice. Even though the villain is the Jew, Shylock, he's given this number of different times where he's able to declare his humanity, you know. And there's that one famous speech he gives: "Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew?" He goes down a list of all these different things that Jewish people share with Gentiles, and so that they're just as much capable of doing anything a Christian can do, you know. And it's this great, beautiful, passage that he says, but there's a lot of other times where you see like this very subversive element in the works, showing women to be pretty much the equal, if not at times superior, intellectually and emotionally to men, you know, throughout the plays. You know, it's there's a lot of different things going on, and just in terms of questioning the power of one person, a dictator. And how much evil and destruction one person can have, and showing how even kings and queens are just as emotionally unstable as a beggar, you know, and just capable of just being completely off the rocker as much as a street layperson can be. And so questioning that idea of the divine right of kings and their ability to reign and run and rule a kingdom
Sounds
properly.
extremely subversive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this has been so interesting. Derek, can you share some last kind of parting thoughts with us and the listeners before telling us where people can find your work?
Sure. I would just say that I think the one thing that I think is important to know, you know, whoever wrote these works, these plays and poetry with William Shakespeare's name on them, is just how not only just how relevant they are in terms of the issues that are being discussed, the characters, how similar they are to us nowadays, 400 years later, just in terms of the relevancy and how much that's still just powerful and really just something worth looking into and enjoying. I think it's also, I think it would be good for us to also just appreciate just how much of a game changer these works were and how much we owe to them. You know, it's just in terms of, you know, when we look back at history and we give credit to people and to groups of people, to different movements, to various different things that were created that people really struggled for and fought for that made certain things today possible for people. I think that, you know, it is definitely a really good argument could be made that the Shakespeare canon really paved the way for so much. And not only the arts and theater and literature and poetry, but in other arts too, just the influence is just enormous, enormous influence of the Shakespeare canon on the arts, but then also outside of the arts in terms of our culture, in terms of the modern culture of how people think of themselves. I think it's really, I think we look at these works and just see how much a big part of who we are we owe to these plays and to this the poems as well. I would just say that that would be a really important thing. And then lastly too would be in terms of the Shakespeare authorship question is definitely worth looking into. And looking into all these different candidates, it's fascinating. It's a lot of fun. It's enjoyable. You'll see things in different ways. You'll see the plays in different ways, the poems in different ways. And it's in what I think I hope that people can kind of take away from is the notion of being a passionate agnostic, and so that one can explore life with different possibilities and be hungry to learn more, to find out more, to see different truths and to learn from them, but also to always leave that a window of uncertainty involved, that there's a possibility that this, however much this may ring true, there's a possibility that there's another perspective has some truth to it as well. So I really want people to enjoy Shakespeare, hopefully maybe, to enjoy these books that I'm writing about it, but also to embrace the agnostic within themselves. And again, I want to say the passionate agnostic within themselves, someone who is willing to explore and find out these things, as well as have doubt as well.
Oh, fuck yeah, I love that. Thank
Oh
you.
yeah, well
So
said.
if people are going to start poking their, toes into the whole Shakespeare pool, where would you suggest people start?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I would suggest, so in just in terms of the two theories that I propose that to me are the most likely, is there's the Thomas More theory, and then now, I'm kind of working on the Anthony Bacon theory. So the Anthony Bacon theory is definitely not something I made up on my own. And so where I came across it was this novel that was written by Daphne du Maurier. So she wrote it, and it was actually published the year I was born, 1977. And it's written as a biography. It seems like a work of nonfiction, but it's a work of fiction. There's a lot, enormous amount of research that she had a team of researchers doing an enormous amount of research. So she, as she researched it, she actually was thinking it was Francis Bacon because, that's who everyone has said in the last 100 years before she wrote that book. But as she was doing more and more research, she came to believe that it was actually Anthony Bacon. And she found a lot of stuff that just led her to believe this. And so she was a very famous writer in her own right. So I think she kind of skirted away from pushing this theory too much. So after she wrote that, she was criticized for even mentioning this idea. And she does it in a very like nondiscreet way too. So it's not like she's shoving it down the reader's throat at all. But so if you're interested, I highly recommend reading her book. It's called Golden Lads. So Golden Lads came out in 1977, and that's an excellent book to look at Anthony Bacon and his life. And then also for the Thomas More theory, I highly recommend people check out the work of Dennis McCarthy. So Dennis McCarthy has been hard at work these last 15 plus years to uncover a lot of evidence that it was Thomas North. He makes great case after great case, and he wrote a book called Thomas North, the author of the original author of Shakespeare's plays. I would recommend going to his website, sirthomasnorth.com. And there's also another guy named Michael Blanding who wrote a book called North by Shakespeare, which was actually a book about Dennis McCarthy and Thomas North. It goes back and forth in time as they search for the truth. That's an excellent book, very well written. So those two, Michael Blanding and Dennis McCarthy, in addition to June Schluter, those three are the Thomas North scholars that I highly recommend checking out. And as far as Anthony Bacon, I highly recommend checking out Daphne du Maurier's book, Golden Lads. And then there's tons and tons of other theories and books and documentaries and movies about the Shakespeare authorship question. There's probably thousands of things you can look into. But in terms of, to me, the two most likely theories, the North theory and the Anthony Bacon theory, that's where I would recommend people go.
All right, right on. Well, if people want to find your work, where should they go to look at that?
The best place to go would be go to my website, which is love-chaos.com. So love-chaos, aos.com. And on there, you'll see all my books, all 16 of them, other stuff I've done, interviews I've done, such as the past one I did with you two, and I think three I did with you, Luxa, already.
Yeah, you've been a guest on my show, Lux Occult, several times. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. So all those interviews I've done with Luxa and other places as well are on there, and other things I've done. But all the links to my books are on there, and also more information about the kind of work that I do is all on there. So, and there's also links to my social media places. There's the Love Chaos Facebook group you can find, and also I'm on Instagram. Those are the two places where I'm most active, is the Love Chaos Facebook group and on Instagram. But best place to go would be on the website love-chaos.com.
All
Right
right.
on.
Right on. Thank you so much, Derek. This has been really fascinating.
Yeah, this has been an absolute pleasure, Derek. Thank you for coming back on. I would love to have you back on maybe when the book is out, and if you're willing to come.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can't get me to shut up about talking about Shakespeare. So, absolutely.
You're the perfect podcast guest because this is just content. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you guys for having me on again. It was an absolute pleasure once again. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, right on. Thank you, Luxa, for setting this all up, and thank you all for joining us. I hope you enjoyed the episode.
Yeah, thank you so much. As your body grows bigger, your mind must flower. It's great to learn, because knowledge is power. Now we know.
And knowing is half the battle. Yeah.